Good evening, friends. This is your host, Franz Weinschenk, welcoming you to another edition of Valley Writers Read, a program where Valley writers get to read their literary prose. And tonight, we're privileged to welcome one of our Valley's most outstanding authors, Mark Arax, who is nationally recognized as a top-notch journalist and author. He's going to read from a book entitled The King of California, which he co-authored with Rick Wartzman. Here's Mark.
King of California, Chapter 1, Winter. We had been chasing Jim Boswell for the better part of 2 years, trying to find the right words that might persuade him to talk. He was a man who had spent half his life safeguarding the family lore. He had once gone to the unusual lengths of hiring a Hollywood screenwriter to gather the stories of his mother and father and kin way back in Georgia. But the stories, covering a century in time, never saw the light of day. Boswell took the voices of his southern past and locked them away in the basement of his California headquarters, where they had been gathering dust for more than 20 years. Now, at age 76, he had no reason to break the tradition of secrecy that began with his uncle, Lieutenant Colonel J.G. Boswell, the founder of the company. The colonel created a culture around the idea that if you ever talked about it, you'd have to give up the game, one Boswell cousin recalled. At family gatherings, they talked about the virtue of stealth this way. As long as the whale never surfaces, they said, it is never harpooned. We tried to convince Boswell that his tale was more than a family tale. We appealed to his sense of history and patrimony, to that piece of the quaint South that still seemed to survive in him, even though he had spent a lifetime conquering the West. None of it worked. Not our strokes to his vanity, not the sheer persistence that his friends said would win him over, not even the writer's little extortion. This book is going to be written without you, and the voices of your critics will echo only louder. His response was to slam the door shut. We finally decided to appeal to his mortality. A sales pitch he cut short like this. You don't seem to understand. It won't bother me in the least if I die, and this story is never told. So it came as some surprise when one day we found ourselves sitting right beside him in a beat-up Chevy truck, his hand with the missing fingers guiding the wheel, barreling straight into the forgotten middle of California. We had met him that morning. Be here at 5:30, and don't forget your pencils to take down all my lies. In the small farm town of Corcoran, where his land and memories crisscrossed in the clay bottoms of an old lake. It sat in the county of Kings on the western flank of the San Joaquin Valley, a land pinched by mountains and rolled out flat and never-ending. We drove for miles and miles across immaculate fields where he had hunted Indian arrowheads as a kid, and then he mercifully stopped to let us take a stretch. We had come to rest on a giant earthen levee, a feat of engineering akin to something in Holland, and he stood on the dusty dike and gazed out across the empire he had snatched from a great inland sea. It was late winter, a few weeks before planting, and everything before him was open earth. Mammoth machines clawed and leveled the land, and crop dusters with their jet engines wide open plowed through the sky, Every square and treeless stretch of it was his, but even as he stood in the bright sunlight, it was hard reading pride in his face. He had a way of keeping even longtime friends and his children guessing, something always held back in the pale blue eyes and thin-lipped smile. The same Boswell face stared out from the portraits of his Scottish forebears, slaveholders and gentlemen farmers who had been chased out of Georgia by the boll weevil in the 1920s and grafted a piece of their cotton plantation onto this immense land. They had brought the South, its mint juleps, its cha-cha relish, its tar paper cotton picker shacks, out west. He wore a Cal Poly ag hat tucked low, khaki pants, a flannel shirt, and Rockport shoes. Not exactly the slops of a farmer about to get dirty with his land, and not exactly the outfit of the absentee corporate landlord that his critics accused him of being. His voice, like the irrigated fields that ran past him to the horizon, hardly rose or fell an inch. And yet he had made it perfectly clear since the first cup of coffee that morning that he didn't appreciate our line of questions, didn't enjoy this exercise of show and tell. He was here under protest, agreeing to talk only after we let it drop that the old-timers of Corcoran were portraying his long-dead father as the town drunk, a man who could pound 9 straight beers without going to the bathroom and still had more sense besotted than a lot of guys do cold sober. Keeping us straight with certain facts about his father, his drunkenness was explained away by family members as a means of numbing, quote, the misery of hemorrhoids. Keeping us straight with those facts was one thing. Entertaining questions about the size of his farming operation and wealth was quite another. What are you, a tax collector? He said, shooting down our question of how much land he really owned. In a tone of half-lecture, he explained, I abhor the word empire. It's a word for nations, for civilizations. Why do you guys have to get into this whole damn big thing anyway? At some point that afternoon, it occurred to us that we had traveled half a day, a distance of some 150 miles, and we had never left his farm. Our route, a slight zigzag across the old lake bottom, took in but half of it. We visited the first cotton patch of his father and uncle, and the farm where his brother Billy, an even harder drinker than his dad, died before his time. We passed the long-gone tent cities of black sharecroppers from Oklahoma and Arkansas, Texas, Louisiana, Georgia, and Mississippi, who had migrated not north to Chicago or Detroit in the 1940s, but followed the cotton trail west to the gut of California. We crossed the levees built by the boom and bust pioneers through 80 years of reclamation and flood, each dike built a little higher than the next to keep the floodwaters on their neighbor's land. And then we passed the faded camps of Mexican migrants and white dust bowlers who journeyed to the San Joaquin Valley for no better reason than they knew how to chop and pick cotton. Each turn of land raised another ghost. That was all Rowan, and right behind it was Flynn. Just to the north of that was Chatham, and north of that was Schwartz, Boswell said, rattling off the old farmers and the giant sections of land named for them. He pointed to a Boswell crew raising the levee along the left bank of the Tule River. Now, if you still had all the original owners over on the right side, they'd be panicking today to see us building up that levee. Why, we asked. Because when the flood hits, the water's going to come their way? That's right, Boswell said. So why isn't anyone panicking now? We own it all, he said. We had driven the equivalent of Washington to Philadelphia, though it seemed pointless to measure it that way, and nearly every road, field, and irrigation canal belonged to Boswell, and every worker we passed and waved to was his worker, and every truck, tractor, and leveler for which he politely moved to the side of the road bore the same Diamond B logo. The goofy grin on a few of their faces made you wonder if they even knew who the old guy waving at them was. He was the biggest farmer in America and the last land baron of California, and he saw no good in playing it up. His 200,000 acres in the middle of the state, just part of his domain, may have ranked as one of the biggest land grabs in the modern West. But to hear him tell it, the product of guile and vision, it was not. A chance encounter here and a little seller's desperation there, and presto, tens of thousands of acres just fell into his lap. The fact that he had built the most highly industrialized cotton operation in the world and had grown more irrigated wheat, safflower, and seed alfalfa than any single farmer in the country and was aiming to do the same with onions and tomatoes, well, the fewer people who knew about that, the better. It was not by accident that Boswell had changed a 200-year-old American institution, altered the way cotton was grown, picked, ginned, and marketed, and hardly anyone outside Kings County knew his name. James Griffin Boswell II, call me Jim, had taken a cue from his uncle, the family patriarch who founded the company from the back of a jitney in 1921, and then married into one of California's most powerful and polished clans, the Chandlers of Los Angeles. Colonel Boswell was a little martinet of a boss who liked to tease his wife, the willful Ruth Chandler, that the men in her family, land developers and publishers of the Los Angeles Times, were weak and soft and not half the man he was. The colonel had no children by Ruth or his first wife, a beautiful and brooding poet who died young. But on long voyages to sell Boswell cotton across the world, he groomed his nephew and namesake in the wisdom of lying low. The Boswell Empire was a secret empire that stretched over the years from the middle of California to Arizona to Oregon to Colorado to the outback of Australia, where Jim Boswell had taken his uncle's pioneering spirit and built a world-class cotton industry from scratch. The no man's land he inhabited in the San Joaquin Valley, reaching across Kings, Fresno, Tulare, and Kern counties, was a forbidding place, howling desert one day, stinking marsh the next. But it had submitted long ago to his vision. The basin had served as a receptacle for three great migrations of workers. The black and white Okies fleeing the sharecropper system were preceded and followed by an even bigger and more sustained waves of migrants from Mexico. Each group of workers huddled in the basin's plywood shanty towns, and the growers turned back every union's attempt to organize them. After calming labor for good in the 1950s, in part by treating his workers better than any other grower, Jim Boswell went about creating a marvel of science and automation, hiring top graduates from the best agricultural colleges in the West. His biotech labs minted new brands of seeds, his precision gins, every bit the industrial wonder of Boeing or U.S. Steel, punched out 400 bales a day of the finest cotton, enough fiber to make 840,000 pairs of boxer shorts. Towels by Fieldcrest, turtlenecks by L.L. Beam, and underwear by Jockey began in these fields. He saw to it that nothing went to waste. The oil milked from the leftover seeds went to Wesson and Frito-Lay. Even when he could squeeze no more out of his fields in Arizona, he still turned them into gold, helping build the first big retirement community in the country, Sun City. The extent of his wealth was a matter of mystery, in part because he lived without ornamentation. By some estimates, his water rights alone were worth billions of dollars, a stockpile eyed with greed on the other side of the mountain by a Los Angeles still hell-bent on expansion. Few of Boswell's contemporaries had ever challenged him. On one of the rare times he was sued by fellow farmers and made to answer questions from a hostile lawyer, he seemed to regard the entire proceeding as a joke. He opened his testimony by wisecracking that he was a cowboy, and he had the missing fingers to prove it. While he liked to play up a rough-grained image, Boswell was a Stanford University graduate who had swapped ideas with the erudite at the Aspen Institute, partied with the elite at the Bohemian Grove, and counted Arnold Palmer as his golf partner. During one round in Australia, Palmer watched a frustrated Boswell hack his way through the first six holes. On the seventh hole, Palmer couldn't resist offering his friend a bit of straightening out. "Jim, if you just move your right hand up a little bit." This was Boswell's bad hand. "Palmer," he said, "when I want your advice, I'll ask for it. You play your game, I'll play mine." When it came time to protect his water rights, he assembled one of the most effective lobbies either the state legislature in Sacramento or the U.S. Congress had ever seen. His boys unseated a congressman who didn't quite see the regulation of big farms his way, and they persuaded the Secretary of the Interior to tear out the teeth of an 80-year-old federal reclamation law, all in the name of keeping Boswell territory in one piece. For 15 years, Boswell served on the board of General Electric, where Chairman Reg Jones and then Jack Welch came to count on him to provide a different view from that of his more buttoned-down peers. Boswell could dissect a balance sheet with the best of him, but his real value to GE was that he came at problems from the vantage of a man out of the Old West. He was a shooter, a fisherman, a hiker of trails, a strategist, and long-term planter, in the words of Jones. "A very independent, outside-the-mold thinker," Jack Welch said. "Just a maverick sort of guy." If Jim Boswell had built the quintessential factory in the fields, it bore no resemblance in his mind to the villainy drawn by writers Frank Norris, Kerry McWilliams, or John Steinbeck, whose narratives of social injustice and corporate farming all met in this same lake bottom. Like his uncle, Boswell left Corcoran early and ran things from afar. He chose to live and work in Los Angeles, Arizona, and Idaho, and his style was to give plenty of rope to his top managers and show his face maybe five times a year, shooting in on the company jet. Still, Corcoran was home, the place where his mother and father and brother Billy were buried. The community of 10,000 billed itself as, quote, "the farming capital of California." Though on the outskirts of town, one old cotton field had given rise to the deadliest prison in America. A 6,000-bed lockup where guards in high-tech booths shot and killed inmates for fistfighting. The same place that Charles Manson, Sirhan Sirhan, and Juan Corona also called home. During picking time, the cotton clung to the prison's razor wire, china berry trees, tumbleweeds, oleanders, and telephone wires, and it snagged on railroad tracks and old ladies' hair and floated like gossamer through the thick air and hung like wet socks after a hard rain. Months later, cotton was still blowing, dirty little balls clumped at the side of Highway 43. Cotton here, cotton everywhere. That first day with Boswell, we took care to steer clear of subjects that might displease him and put a stop to our conversation right there. The idea of dealing with reporters struck him as so needless and foreign that when you called company headquarters, there was no PR flack to answer even the most basic question. If they were lucky, reporters might be referred to corporate counsel Ed Gierman, a man so dyspeptic that he returned maybe 1 out of 10 calls, and then only to say, with an unmistakable glee, that the company's comment was no comment. That morning, looking for ways to break the ice, we mentioned to Boswell how cotton debris from past harvests adorned the drive into town. The bits of white stuff on the side of the road hardly seemed a blight on Corcoran. Corcoran was, after all, a place that announced itself to the world with a skyline of grain silos 5 stories tall and countless metal farm shops, all in shades of industrial gray. Boswell, though, took offense. Leftover cotton, whether it belonged to him or some other ginner, messed with his notion of cleanliness. His crews took care to rake, sweep, and pile all errant cotton in the fields and ginning yards, making bales out of detritus. No fiber, he assured us, had blown into town or been lost on the drive to market. Now, cleanliness is the main thing. Our philosophy is that it's a lot easier to keep something clean than it is to keep it dirty. We're not farmers, he said. We're implementers, and nobody can implement better than we can. The giant levee where we had come to rest that afternoon cut across the confluence of 3 of the 4 rivers that met on Boswell's land. So complete was nature's bending that the absurdity of where he was standing, smack dab in the bottom of a lake, or rather what was once the largest body of fresh water west of the Mississippi, this fact no longer struck him. He and a handful of farmers before him had sucked Tulare Lake dry and made its rivers run backwards. No landscape in America, not the cotton South, not the grain belt of the Midwest, not the cane fields of Florida, had been more altered by the hand of agriculture. It was a landscape every bit as engineered as the Mississippi Valley, and far more intensively cultivated. The scale was so unheard of that they had to invent their own one-of-a-kind machines, monster moon buggies, to suck water out of canals and hurl it across the fields. Against the will of 2 presidents, Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, the Boswells and other Kings County growers had convinced the federal government to make an extraordinary philosophical concession. The 4 rivers that followed their enduring path from the mountains to the valley weren't replenishing a freshwater lake with origins way back when. Rather, powerful congressmen and bureaucrats decided that the rivers were agents of flood, and it was productive farmland, the future of the West, they were flooding. Even at the bottom of a lake, floods had to be controlled, and controlling them was the domain of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. One by one, beginning in the 1940s, they dammed the 4 rivers in the foothills above the valley. Projects underwritten in part by payments from Boswell and other growers. This dam building was eventually topped by an even sweeter prize. The farmers, served by the irrigation releases from the dams, could grow their crops without any worry about the 960-acre limitation that constrained farmers elsewhere. Here in Kings County, the federal law didn't apply. The irrigated farms of Tulare Lake could grow as big as they liked. In the event that the dam tenders were forced to release water beyond the needs of irrigation, the farmers had their own elaborate devices downstream to check the rivers. The South Central Levee, rising 20 feet high and 120 feet wide and extending more than 7 miles, sliced the basin in 2 and could stop the lake cold. It was the centerpiece, the big daddy, of hundreds of miles of dikes and canals that formed a massive crisscrossing network to stave off the proverbial 100-year flood, and certainly anything smaller. But every 15 years or so, the great Phantom Lake still managed to stir. The dams of Uncle Sam and the clay walls and hydraulic plumbing of the farmers proved no match for the record spring snow melts that came busting out of the Sierra and down the rivers Kings, Tule, Cahuilla, and Kern. 1938, 1952, 1969, 1983, 1997, 1998. Each year came with a heavy spring thaw that flooded thousands of acres of cotton and grain fields. And so the old Indian Lake returned, a land of 10 million geese. Standing on the levee with Boswell, watching his gaze fix on the irrigated fields, we began to sense the lake as a concept did not exist for him. Sure, he had plenty of respect for the damage that the four rivers could bring, but the construction of the dams had trumped nature, at least a good portion of the time. The rivers weren't so much rivers now as they were precise bands of stationary water, nearly impossible to tell apart from the irrigation canals. And what the four rivers were emptying into was no longer a lake, so much as a big sump that every so often got in the way of agriculture. Like the maps that showed Tulare Lake as a brown or empty spot in the southwest corner of California, the word lake had been practically wiped clean from the farmer's nomenclature. Boswell commissioned Hollywood producer David Volper and screenwriter David Val, whose credits included the original Dragnet TV series, to make a film praising the death of Tulare Lake. It was in the mid-1960s, a time when the Phantom Lake seemed gone for good. The film, called The Big Land, brought to mind a government production with just enough dramatic music to keep awake a high school civics class. The film began with an aerial shot of the old lake, the buzz of the plane rousing thousands of shorebirds. This is Tulare Lake. For centuries, it has been a catch basin for waters flowing down from the High Sierra 80 miles away, the voice read. Once it ranged over 600 square miles, the uncontested master of the valley. Now it's become the lake that was, its waters controlled, its bottom reclaimed. Once master, it's now servant. Once desolate, it's now fertile. The difference is man. The film ended 35 minutes later with another aerial view, this time of fields gold and green. Simply by moving into the 20th century, the American farmer has become a giant. No longer does he serve the land. The land serves him. The film, to borrow an old farmer's phrase, was a case of premature nut-licking. Four more floods, some more epic than others, would follow. The lake, described in company archives as a geologic freak with no outlet to the sea, had marked Boswell's youth and tested his wits. Mostly, though, it was an object to tame, and he now viewed it from a purely clinical vantage. To conceive of Tulare Lake as its own entity with historical and environmental import, indeed one of the greatest wetlands in the West, might mean that it wasn't quite the adversary whose stubborn insistence had to be beaten back with an all-out assault. The lake's beauty, the speed with which it found its old self, was a wonder to behold. The spectacle offered no warning. During the back-to-back flood years of 97 and 98, visitors wanting to glimpse a piece of California's unruly past drove across a flat expanse of land, past vineyards and almond orchards, past dairies and alfalfa fields, until the road suddenly quit at the base of a huge earthen wall. The air filled with the faint smell and sound of ocean. Climbing atop the muddy embankment, gaping at the lake's big belly, you felt lost for a moment and dizzy with vertigo. Was this the heart of cotton country or the New Jersey shore? The wind whipped white caps past telephone poles that displayed the high water stains of past revivals. The lake was brown in parts and pure blue in others, and the sun glinted off flocks of mud hens, pintail and mallard ducks, giant blue and white herons, and pelicans scooping up catfish. For Boswell, such beauty seemed almost beside the point. He found it a lot easier to talk about the floods and the heroic fights to defy gravity and dewater the lake. Dewater, that was his word. In the flood of 1969, economic fate of Corcoran and much of Kings County rested on efforts to save the bonanza wheat harvest and keep dry more than 100,000 acres set aside for the spring cotton planting. Boswell said he had never seen a winter like 69. The snowpack was a monster, bigger than at any time in recorded history. And more was on the way. By mid-February, the spring thaw, a three-month meltdown had begun and was already flooding the lowest fields. Boswell and other farmers enlisted shovels, hoes, and huge earth movers to shore up the levees and installed 50 gargantuan pumps along the Tule to keep the river from jumping its banks. In the midst of their efforts, the sky broke open with yet another torrent of rain. "Rain halts farming, flood threat grows," screamed the headline in the February 20, 1969 Corcoran Journal. "Like the war in Vietnam, our farmers are embattled, alert, and doing everything possible to prevent and minimize flood losses sure to be sustained in our community this year of the great flood in Tulare Lake." If the writing was a little breathless, biblical even, it was appearing in a weekly newspaper owned by Boswell and a handful of other big growers, all of them facing the same catastrophe. Boswell's top men knew more about the movement of water, how to make it appear in drought and disappear in flood, than anyone else in the business. But they had never faced a flood of this magnitude, and it wasted no time exposing the folly of their approach. They had been attempting to blunt the impact of the waters and spare the crops the old way by shoving the spring runoff onto junky lowlands and trapping the water behind holding cells. All their efforts had been geared to keeping dry 30,000 acres of prime land in District 749, which ran alongside the swollen Tule. What they didn't figure on was that the water release from the Sierra dams would be so great that it overwhelmed any contrivances they could muster downstream. The river was about to bust through the big levee, and if Boswell lost the Tule, he would not only lose District 749, but also a main office and cotton gins. In a gesture of near surrender, they decided to tear a gash in the riverbank and flood the best land on purpose. It sounded ass backward, washing out the very fields they were trying to save. But cutting into the Tule would prevent a series of uncontrolled breaks downriver, an even bigger disaster. With the claws of three massive earth movers, Boswell's men punched a hole in the Tule and watched it surge out. It proved more than a bloodletting. The river was hemorrhaging. "Major flood disaster strikes Tulare Lake," the Corcoran Journal shouted. "Water covers 80 square miles. basin, now in danger. The lake had doubled in size, wiped out the fields of 749, and was threatening to swallow the town. Boswell recalled one desperate Sunday afternoon in the middle of it all when he grabbed his shovel and headed out to a levee that provided the difference between make and break. I was the only guy out there, he explained. The water was rising, and it was starting to come over the top of the levee, and I thought if I could just get a shovel here, I might stop it. It might not rise anymore. A friend came by and said, "What the hell are you doing out here, Jim?" I said, "If I can hold it and keep it from going over the top tonight, maybe it'll go down tomorrow." The neighbor then turned to Boswell and planted a wild scheme of an idea. All the earth in the world wasn't going to shore up the main levee against the constant lashing of the waves. A black man on the other side of town had 40 or 50 junk cars, and they would make a perfect buffer. "Let's haul them out here tonight," the neighbor suggested. The next morning, Boswell put out the word to every wrecking yard in the valley. $15 per car, ASAP, cash on delivery. The line of tow trucks freighted with pancake jalopies grew so long that it meandered for miles. As the rain poured down, Boswell's foreman, strong boxes in arm, paid every junkman a 10 and a 5 spot. 5,200 jalopies in all, $78,000. Then, using cranes, they laced 8 miles of the big curved levee with Chevys, Cadillacs, Eldorados, Pontiacs, and Thunderbirds, a bumper-to-bumper bulwark. The newspaper took a picture from the air. The junks looked like fine beads on a fancy necklace. The crazy scheme had worked. The lake ended up holding at 130 square miles. "We saved the El Rico levee that way," Boswell told us. "You know, I've had 2 500-year floods in my life and 4 100-year floods." He said this without a trace of irony. You never give up fighting floods in the lake bottom. Don't give up. The heroes of the 1969 flood were toting shotguns as well as shovels in the middle of the night, farmer against farmer. On one levee, a revered Boswell manager named Les Doan confronted Fred Salyer, the son of a rival farm family. Only days before, Doan had installed a series of pumps to move floodwater off Boswell's best land. Salyer, in the company of an armed guard, wanted the water to stay put. Salyer land was dry, thanks to that big levee that partitioned the lake bottom in two. Salyer wanted the water to remain on the other side of his levee, close enough so that he could dip his straw when it came time for irrigation. In other words, Salyer wanted his neighbors to bear the entire burden of the flood, but share with him the later benefits of its water. Clutching a letter from his attorney, Salyer ordered his tractor driver to upend the Boswell pumps and stop the drainage. The pumps were bobbing like corks in the surging river when Les Doan showed up and promised Salyer that he'd get even. The bad blood from the 69 flood ended up flowing all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, where the Boswells and Salyers squared off in a landmark water case. The Salyer clan was led by a Virginia hillbilly named Clarence, a one-time mule driver who came to Tulare Lake in 1918, a few years before the Boswells. Old Clarence had the misfortune of a mangled eye that wandered so far to the left that all you saw was white. The eye, which earned him the cruel moniker Cockeye, was not the worst of his features. He had a big belly and bulbous nose and not a single pretension when it came to personal style. Whether firing or rehiring one of his employees which he often did in the same breath, or storming into Governor Pat Brown's office to give him a good chewing out. Salyer dressed the same. Slouch hat, chinos, an old brown coat, and scuffed cowboy boots. He drove a mud-cake Cadillac in and out of the fields and let his pet collies, Sinner and Saint, make their home on the front seat. As with Boswell's missing fingers, there were a dozen different stories to explain the disobedience of Clarence's eye, most of them a variation on the staggering amounts of hard liquor he consumed, 16 dry martinis in one sitting, his savage temper, and the sheer merriment he brought to the act of screwing family, friends, employees, and his longtime lover. With a fourth-grade education, Cockeye Salyer had amassed 88,000 acres of prime farmland, only second to Boswell. On his deathbed, Colonel Boswell rued the day he gave Cockeye his start and the years he loaned him money on each cotton crop. Clarence boasted, "I'll buy hell if the Boswells put the down payment on it." Money didn't mean a damn thing to Cockeye, friend said. Land, now that's what mattered to him. He was too busy gobbling up 640 acre squares to worry about debts. Though a millionaire many times over, he papered the town with bad checks, his bank account perpetually depleted from having bought another piece of land. A lifelong Ponzi scheme kept him one step ahead of the bill collector and most of his own workers, too. Clarence would never miss a payday, one longtime employee recalled, but sometimes the checks weren't so good. One late afternoon, in the middle of polishing off a quart of bourbon at the Brunswick Club, his foreman, a large man known as Big Swede, grabbed Clarence by the coat and knocked him to the floor with a single stunning blow. Then he reached into the boss's pocket and grabbed some of the back wages owed him. As Clarence dusted himself off, his good eye still silly, he is said to have inquired, "Is there anybody else here I owe money to?" By some accounts, he could be a lovely host. The few times Ruth Chandler came to Corcoran, she delighted in his company at lunch. During dove hunting season, he made sure the boys from Los Angeles, Clark Gable and John Wayne, bagged their limit. And before he turned on Pat Brown, sneaking into the state capitol one night to personally serve the recoiling governor a lawsuit, Cockeye acted as Brown's bagman. His son Fred flew them from dusty airstrip to dusty airstrip, collecting campaign loot from valley farmers. Tired of playing errand boy, Fred told his father that he didn't much care for the grubby-handed Pat Brown and thought even less of his overbearing wife. Cockeye ordered him to keep flying. Years later, after his boys had exiled him to a Delta farm hundreds of miles north, and successive generations of Salyers had sued each other until their empire was no more, it was whispered that Cockeye had committed murder and gotten away with it. He shot a man in cold blood during the labor strife of the 1930s, the story went, and his son Fred helped him get rid of the gun. As we resumed our tour with Jim Boswell across the lake bottom, he assured us that his success was not due to government subsidies, but to guts and teamwork, from the top bosses down to the irrigator making $6 an hour. Still, with our tour of his farm winding down, we pressed him on the notion of welfare for the rich. Several years ago, Jim, newspapers were calling you the biggest recipient of federal crop subsidies in the country. And for cotton, a surplus crop. That's the most ridiculous, asinine statement, he said. Anytime somebody wants to make an argument, an anti-argument, a non-constructive argument, they use the word subsidy or surplus. Those are code words. They're not realistic. Yes, we've been entitled to subsidy checks, but never did we take them. You never took the money? No, sir. We sent back a check. Came out of Washington. How much was that check for? I want to say it was in the millions. And you've done that more than once?
Yes, he said. Well, let's say the newspapers are half right, Jim, and you did take a check once or twice. Wouldn't it stand to reason that because of your immense size, it would have been an immense check? I hate the word immense. Let's see, you abhor the word empire and you hate the word immense. You're going to take away half our vocabulary before we're done. I mean, you can't get around the fact that you're the biggest farmer in the country. How in the hell are you going to get around that? I've gotten around it damn well without you guys for 50 years. He farmed the equivalent of more than 10 Manhattan Islands with only 300 salaried employees. It was efficiency without compromising excellence, from sea to field to gin to bale yard. Because his picking season was short and no man stayed on the payroll beyond his labors, Boswell made a practice of hiring husbands and wives, parents and their grown children. He placed them in different phases of the operation, some in summer, others in winter, so families could maintain a steady flow of wages throughout the year. In some clans, three generations wore the same Boswell blue diamond on their uniforms. You're probably going to think this is a bunch of bull, but my biggest concern is the employees, he told us. How are we going to provide for them and keep them on during good times and flood? We have the best benefits program of any farming operation in the country. Major medical, retirement, profit sharing, stock option plan. So we keep our people. He reached down and picked up a clump of hard gray soil and busted it apart with his half hand. The beauty of the heavy clay was it had held the winter rain for a long time. Once the danger of frost had passed, the clumps could be kneaded out of the land, and the soil would still maintain enough moisture just below the surface to germinate an entire field. They called it farming the top inch. That's what we're doing right now. They're knocking down the old borders, and this will all go into cotton, he said. Below the levee and across the field, a newfangled tractor powered by belts, Jeep-like, carved one-inch scallops into the earth. Boswell squinted into a sun that suddenly felt like spring and then lingered for a few moments on a field of wheat bursting to his left and miles of open land ready for cottonseed to his right. Look at how beautiful that is out there, he said. You're at the bottom of the lake.
That was Mark Arax reading from a book he co-authored with Rick Wartzman entitled The King of California. The book mainly deals with J.G. Boswell, who's considered one of the biggest, if not the biggest, farmer in America. Mark's story mainly dealt with a seldom-told story of how Boswell's family, originally from Georgia, migrated to California in the early 20s and then, along with a few others, managed to drain the biggest freshwater lake west of the Mississippi, originally known as Tulare Lake, and carved out the richest cotton empire in the world. Boswell built this unbelievable agricultural giant while basically ignoring the forces of nature and pretty much thumbing his nose at politicians, labor unions, and journalists as he established what he calls a factory in the fields. Indeed, experts tell us that the sophistication of Boswell's agricultural enterprise comes from his superb skill of operating from the lab to the field to the gin. Friends, listeners to Valley Writers Read probably remember that we've been fortunate to have had Mark Arax on our show numerous times. His first book, In My Father's Name, is a stirring memoir that weaves together the history of his Armenian family. And what we heard tonight was from his second book, The King of California, co-authored with Rick Wartzman. The book won the California Book Award as well as the William Saroyan International Writing Prize. Mark has recently come out with a third book, which is a collection of short stories called West of the West, Dreamers, Believers, Builders, and Killers in the Golden State. We congratulate him on his fine writing and certainly thank him for his contribution to our show. And so we come to the end of another edition of Valley Writers Read. Thank you for listening. If you would like to listen to tonight's or any other Valley Writers Read program again, just go online at kvpr.org and click on to Valley Writers Read. Next week, our author will be Howard Hendricks. In the meantime, this is your host, Franz Weinschenk, wishing you and yours a great life story until we meet again. Good night.
Valley Writers Read is a production of Valley Public Radio produced by Don Weaver and Franz Weinschenk. Please join us again next Wednesday at 7 p.m. for another edition of Valley Writers Read.